Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. This week, photographer Elena Raman Durante from Galicia talks about Spain and particularly about Catalonia. Also, Paul Weston is down in Glastonbury and does a blog about Glastonbury affairs. He's looking at Richard Whiting, the abbot of Glastonbury, who was killed in 1539 by Henry VIII for not handing over his monastery as part of the dissolution. He's also the author of a YouTube film called Glastonbury Abbey Dreams. And Eric Simon speaks to us about money creation and the money system. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
But my name is Elena Roman. I come from the north of Spain, Santiago de Compostela, Spain, and I'm in England because I'm trying to improve my English.
Okay, well, you're doing very well, and thank you for coming on the radio. Your country's going through some turmoils at the moment.
Yeah.
Some people saying that the political leaders in Catalonia have broken the law and they should go to jail.
Yeah. I mean,
in fact, the police chief has been sent to jail, and some of the political leaders.
I mean, I don't know how it's going to be all about it, but in one side, I'm in the middle. I'm somehow neutral because I'm from Galicia, that I'm not even Spanish or Catalonian.
I mean, hang on, you are Spanish. I mean, Galicia is part of Spain.
Well, yes, it is, but I'm like another independent autonomy of Spain, right? So Spain, when you talk about Spain, is Madrid and the south. Because later on, the north is so different.
What's the difference then between Madrid and the south and places like Catalonia and where you're from and the Basque Country, which is,
well,
on the French border?
Probably we need to go really, really back on the past, because Franco, all the north of Spain, they somehow forget about them.
Right. Well, this is maybe because the land is not so good, maybe for agriculture, this kind of thing. It's more. Maybe, I mean, certainly the Pyrenees is very rocky. Why was it then?
Do you think I don't want to be so good. I think they have personality. They have their own language. They have their own
tradition. But you speak Spanish, don't you?
Yeah.
In Galicia?
Yeah. But I do speak Galician too.
Okay. Is that a dialect? A bit like...
A dialect from Portugal.
Ah, right. Okay.
So Catalonia comes from a dialect from France. Well, I don't know how it comes. And I agree with them that they want the independence. Probably they feel like myself as a Gallegic, that I have my own language and my own culture and my own music, different as Spain. But probably I can be a little bit more different as a Spanish, or at least as the culture of Spain.
Okay, so Portugal, I imagine, I don't know my history, Portugal, did they have a fight to be independent from Madrid too?
Probably they have it since a long time ago. I mean, everybody wants to be identified.
So what about this government with Rajoy and Felipe, the king, the Prime Minister Rajoy? Who are these people and what are they like?
Well, for me, it's a little bit like, I don't know, it's my own way of think. I'm not saying it is or not. It's just my way of thinking, but it's a little bit communist.
Communist?
Are radical on the ways. I mean, they are a little bit hot, reds.
Reds. So hang on, because the Civil War was surely, it was about the communists who were the Republicans really fighting against the fascists. But Rajoy's
fascist
party...
No, perdona, fascist. They're a little bit fascist. They're red in their way. I mean...
Hang on. Okay, so this is a bit confusing for me, and maybe you can help, because I think of the communists as being the reds. I'm thinking really about the Russian Revolution, and the Russian communists were the reds, and the right wing in Russia were the whites. So is it not the same in the Spanish Civil War?
Bueno, I don't know how to explain it, but in Spain we have the PP, right? Rajoy.
People's Party, yeah.
Rajoy, at the moment, is in a government that is the same Labour as it was the Franco.
Right. It's the same party, isn't it? Isn't it
Franco's
the same
party?
Yeah.
I don't know, blue or red. Maybe I get confused. But it's the same way. right? It's the same way of they will think.
So if you were in Madrid and you had a word in the ear of Mariano Rajoy, the Prime Minister, what would you be saying to him?
What I was saying to him, I don't know, because in Spanish it's so corrupt that we don't even matter about politics anymore.
Really?
We just want...
I mean, you've got massive unemployment,
have a good time, have a good time, have a survivor.
Don't you have a democracy?
No, we don't have democracy. I mean, I came to Spain 4 years ago, coming after Asia, when I would travel a lot, and I come back, and all my friends was losing house on a crisis because they couldn't pay. A lot of people lost his work. I don't know. It was a crisis time.
Well, they did have, I know, there's a scandal, the Gürtel scandal in Spain, where the Rajoy and various people from the PP, the People's Party, were taking a lot of bribes. And
I think Spain is all corrupted.
Yeah. I mean, well, the thing is that they had a...
So I can't understand why the Catalans wants to be independent.
Right. Okay, well, that's interesting.
It's corrupted.
Who wants to pay taxes to a government that's corrupt? Nobody.
I mean, who wants to pay tax?
Well, I think people don't mind if they think it's going to be spent on health,
of course,
on this sort of thing, education.
If you trust your government.
Right.
But in this day, Spain, we know that it's been all full, corrupt.
What's been the situation for people trying to get work in Spain then?
But it's bad because I study. I have a good CV. I studied 2 or 3 careers. I speak many languages. And when I went back to Spain, I couldn't find a proper job. And when I found a proper job and I was so high, people took me back. So, no, it's not. As a single woman, or you know, just a single woman, even families. No. It's a system that somehow is not developing. You cannot develop.
So that's one of the reasons you're over here as well, maybe.
Well, myself, I'm a little bit different because I'm a freelance photographer. So I like to change and have these dynamic things in my life. But thinking back, Spanish people, they are somehow saying like they are collapsed on the system because you bought a house with a mortgage, blah, blah, blah. You have a job, blah, 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 blah. Very good. But at the moment that these two things doesn't work, you lost. You don't have even help for any type of government. You don't have help. Imagine, I mean, I don't know, but I have friends at the same age as me that they start to pay a house when they was 21. More than having children or think what they need to do. Paying a house 21. Now I go back and they are already 34, right? They lost the houses because wasn't any job to call to pay the mortgage. They are on the street, living now with his parents. Now they are with the parent, but they still need to pay the mortgage. They lost the house and go on.
This is what they call
on,
negative equity. Yeah.
So this is Spain, right? The facility you come. So I can understand very well why they want independence, because we are living now in a region that we don't know if it's freedom, we don't know if it's blah, 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 but we don't have even the right as a human being.
What do you think, is this something to do with the Brussels or is it just Madrid? Is it?
No, I think it's corrupted. They don't care about us.
Because the European Union has come really behind Rajoy.
Rajoy come from the system that they are, how I say, red or blue, they are hardcore. And if you don't follow the system that you don't want, you're out. And probably Catalonia just wanted to be independent because we are sick of corruption.
Do you think where you live, Galicia and places like the Basque country will try and do the same?
Yeah, of course. Even they have their own police, they have their own council, they have their own even way of life. Even the way of life is different as Spain. And yes, I think they will do. And even the Basque Country already do a lot. Even they grew up as association called ETA. That really they was fighting for independence, because what it is, Spain or is not democratic yet. So if you have this system that they say yes or no, if you want to be independent because you try to fight that you are one, and I think Spain is still really background, and I think Catalonia is only fighting to look for their own rights as an individual. I mean, because Spain is still so complex. So, I don't know how you say it, but it's still really the root. In Madrid is the root as Franco.
So what are they talking about actually in Spanish? Do you want to say something in Spanish, which is this kind of thing that people will be saying?
Pues mira, yo en Spain, pues I hope in Spain one day it will be really a democratic country, that even these little places that we are always in front because we don't have a good communication, goes all together. Because at the moment, we are a small country with so many different type of way of manners, type even the way of food, the way of even culture and music. You go to the north and the music is not flamenco. And everybody thinks that in Spain is flamenco. No. You go to the north and it's Celtic. You go to Catalonia and it's totally different. And it's happened the same. In Catalonia, you speak another language. Catalonia is, you know, you go to Catalonia and it's like a 10-year more developing Spain. Catalonia is like a cosmopolitan city, like it's London in your country. We don't have that in Spain. In Spain, it's so backwards.
Okay, now say something in Spanish, in the Spanish language. Whatever you want to say.
Bueno, afortunadamente, en las noticias de hoy, he descubierto de que, bueno, yo hoy vivo en Inglaterra, y he descubierto de que en España hay un gran, gran conflicto entre Cataluña y Madrid. Y yo creo que Cataluña tiene todos los derechos para ser independiente. Y que luche y luche y luche y luche mucho por ser independiente. Pero Madrid también tiene su territorio. Lo que no entiendo yo, ¿por qué se busca todo en cogerlos y meterlos en prisión?
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Paul Western. I'm living in Glastonbury. And 10 years ago, I wrote a book called Mysterium Artorius, which is all about Glastonbury and the Abbey and the Arthurian associations. And I've been very, very interested in the Abbey, and I'm a season ticket holder there, and I've been in there, you know, two or three times a week for the whole 20 years.
Amazing. I mean, I didn't know there were season tickets. How much does that something like that cost, so you can go in there regularly?
Well, that's variable. I've got a family ticket, which gets another adult, two children in, and that's £66 for an entire year, which is actually very reasonable, considering that you can go in there every single day.
So how can you manage to go so many times a week? I mean, effectively the Abbey is now derelict.
Well, the Abbey is obviously a place that is open to the public. There's a tremendous amount of events that go on there. You know, there are people, historical reenactment individuals who take people on tours. I myself am an independent tour guide. The place is open to the public, and there's a museum in there. It's the very heart of Glastonbury geographically.
But doesn't it cost? I mean, if you're visiting, will probably cost about, I don't know, £15 to go in or something like that, which just sounds a bit steep.
I think it's about £6 or whatever. The grounds are enormous. And the ruins are tremendously poetic and evocative, and there is a huge atmosphere in the place. And of course, you know, the center of gravity for most people is the controversial, contentious, alleged grave of King Arthur, you know, the big event that
occurred. Tell us about your book. What was it, Mysterious or something? It sounded like Latin.
Mysterium Artorius. Yes, it is Latin. Mysterium is kind of almost a mystical term that gives you a sense of something that is mysterious, but not in the normal way, something that has a certain mood, a certain aura about it that evokes the poetic sensibilities in people, which we can certainly say that the myths and legends of Arthur and the Grail and also the whole history and mythology of Glastonbury definitely do.
Now, what about this whole thing about the Grail and Arthur? Because certainly one of the things I've read is that the abbots, when the monastery was in its heyday, actually peddled these as kind of myths in order to sort of get more people to come. And this was the idea is to create this kind of, in a way, what I suppose we'd now call a kind of PR mystique around the place.
Well, the Grail is not something that is ever directly associated with the establishment of Glastonbury, if you like. Obviously, whoever was dug up in 1191 and the association at the time was Arthur, it can clearly be interpreted as something that's a bit of propaganda and a bit of PR to bring in punters and pilgrims. But there are many things about the whole business which are very, very intriguing. I'm not necessarily somebody that will argue that it was the one and only King Arthur, but there's something about these legends, there's something about the mood that they evoke in relation to the very, very numinous landscape that we've got around here with the famous Tour and the rolling hills and the light that plays across them, that enables you to enter into an appreciation of the mythology and the history of this country and this land, and how that's something that is actually a world treasure, that there's something for everybody to somehow connect to in that, potentially.
Okay, well, I know it's a bit cheeky, but can I ask you to review your own book? What's some of the interesting bits and pieces that you've dug up in there?
Right, well, okay. I mean, my sense is that, first and foremost, the way into Glastonbury for the average person is the mystique of the landscape. You know, Glastonbury Tor dominates the entire landscape for miles around, and it changes shape wherever you are in the town as you come towards it. It's continually shifting and changing. There are places in the town that you can't even see it. You can't really see it that in the Abbey itself. These are the kind of things that in the past people that live more closely related to the landscape will notice, and it will become something significant. The place was virtually an island, not completely an island, but virtually an island in pre-Roman times. And people didn't actually live here. They lived around the lake villages out near and so forth. And they undoubtedly would have seen Glastonbury Tor and seen the isle around it as something potentially numinous, sacred, interesting. And there's a good case to be made for saying that it may have been a place where the dead were buried, that it was an otherworld island.
What about the symbolism of the Tor? I mean, is it supposed to symbolise something, parts of the anatomy or whatever?
Well, there's an awful lot of different responses to the Tor and its mythology and history. In the modern world, we've now got a goddess temple in Glastonbury. There are many people who are enthusiasts for the divine feminine, and it's definitely true that in Celtic culture, such as in Ireland and so on, in days gone by, rolling hills become associated with the female body, the shape of the female body, and goddesses. So there's certainly, you know, anyone that looks at it in that way, there is a certain poetry in that, and at certain times of the year, you know, one can enter into a whole mystique surrounding that.
I mean, there's a very practical sort of epicenter, spiritual epicenter in Glastonbury, and that is the role that the Abbey played in the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII. Now, we're just at the moment celebrating the 500th anniversary since the Reformation. Martin Luther and Calvin and the rest of them over in Germany started this wave of reform in the church. Henry VIII picked up these ideas with a vengeance, got rid of the Catholics, started the Church of England, got rid of various wives, and that kind of thing. And of course, was one of the, you know, he was the key figure behind the dissolution of the monasteries. Can you tell us, first of all, what sort of interaction there was between the monasteries and the local community? And then maybe we can have a look at what happened in Glastonbury specifically.
Well, as far as Glastonbury is concerned, the Abbey owned a lot of land in the immediate vicinity. So the agriculture, the fishing and so on, the production and distribution of food was something that the monks were very much involved in. They were very much part of a wider community. And would, you know, had hospitals and almshouses and so on, and tried to look after people. I think there's every indication that people were fairly well off comfortably and had a reasonable quality of life, as much as you can say anybody that's lower class in the Middle Ages would have done.
I'm just thinking, because up in Bristol we've got the Bristol Royal Infirmary, the BRI. You know, this word infirmary is pretty much taken directly from what the monks used to provide with their... They did quite a large amount of medical care. Some people have even compared them to something equivalent to the modern National Health Service.
Well, there's certainly a case to be said that the monasteries kept a level of culture and learning alive during a period that was, you know, not as good for the wider population, and that they did have, however much money that they had, there is an ongoing sense of responsibility to the wider community.
Yeah, and what happened to Richard Whiting? He's this famous abbot who was, he was one of the last people really to put up an absolutely stalwart resistance to Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries. And what people don't necessarily understand is what was happening is Henry VIII was effectively privatising the monasteries, saying that and selling them off to some of his rich feudal friends.
Well, I don't think it's really true to say that that Abbot Whiting put up a great resistance to Henry VIII. I mean, part of the deal was when the Church of England was founded that everybody was required to sign over their allegiance to it. And he did so, and so indeed did everyone else in Glastonbury Abbey. And this is widespread across the entire country. But he becomes the symbol of the brutality of the way in which ultimately the process of the dissolution of the monasteries was handled, because of the terrible fate that befalls him and indeed befalls the whole of Glastonbury Abbey in 1539. You know, we are coming up next week to the anniversary of that, to the anniversary of his martyrdom.
So the anniversary of his martyrdom. So what happened to him? I mean, this is 1539. If you could imagine, that was about 20 years really after Martin Luther and various things have been happening in Germany, the Reformation, the wave spread across Europe. And so what happened to Richard? I mean, he decided, I think, didn't he, that he wasn't going to allow the Glastonbury Abbey to be demolished and sold off like the others.
That's not really exactly how the whole thing went down. The dissolution of the monasteries, it's certainly an after effect, if you like, of the Protestant Reformation, but it's very much tied in with Henry VIII and his power politics. It starts in 1536, and Glastonbury, being the jewel in the crown, the richest and the biggest, is kind of left pretty much for last, and it creeps up on us. And finally gets moving in 1539. And there are allegations made against Whiting that he's committed treachery, that he's taken money and treasures and so on. And it's very interesting that there's extant documentation that tells you how much of a put-up job it was, because there's an itinerary whereby he's to be taken to call in Wells to be tried and then executed. So it's quite clear that, you know, the trial is just a show trial. It's always intended that he's going to be executed.
So why was it? What had he really done wrong?
it's simply a case of this is what was necessary in order to gain control of the tremendous resources of Glastonbury Abbey and to intimidate everybody around to not resist in any way. Now, there are suggestions that there are stranger motives in the background, and we can see this in the way in which the whole horrible scenario pans out. Because Richard Whiting is an elderly man. He's an octogenarian. No one really has got a word to say against him. He's a fine fellow. But what they do is they condemn him to be hung, drawn and quartered on Glastonbury Tor along with a couple of his associates. And this involves stretching him out on a hurdle that is then pulled by a horse from outside Glastonbury Abbey and up onto the Tor, which is quite a difficult thing to manage in November when it's often quite muddy and on the lower slopes of the Tor, when it might be raining, when it's quite often very, very windy on the Tor. Three gallows are set up on the Tor, and Whiting is there, and he's hung, drawn and quartered, and his head's displayed on a pole and so on later on in the vicinity. Local author Geoffrey Ash wondered in a book that he wrote about that featured all this story called King Arthur's Avalon, whether or not, because of the sheer impracticality of it, why, you know, it wouldn't just be done in the town centre if all that was necessary was to instill fear in people. It's almost like a blasphemous parody of the crucifixion. It's unnecessarily brutal anyway. In order for Henry VIII to gain control of this place, he didn't have to go that far. And all of the priceless resources of it, the incredible library, rather than just grabbing it for and assimilating it into the Royal Library or giving it to some university, the whole thing, we don't really know what happened to it. It's lost, essentially. I'm sure some people managed to grab some of it, but it's a national treasure, it's a national resource, and it's lost. And it's also not true to say that the Abbey is just taken down straight away. It takes a while. In fact, it takes decades for it to be slowly, denuded into its ruinous form.
I mean, I like your take on this as it being a kind of blasphemous act. You know, I imagine that would really instill fear into the locals, saying we really can't meddle, we can't really fight back against this King Henry VIII. He's all powerful and he's instilling fear. But just explain hanging, drawing and quartering. That's something which was quite a hideous medieval way of killing somebody, executing them. Can you tell us what it involved, if you can, if you can stump
it? Well, I mean, you are hung until virtually dead. And then basically, you know, your stomach's cut open and, you know, your guts are taken out and so on. It's, you know, this is an octogenarian. This is a guy who's been an abbot of the greatest religious institution in the country. As far as I'm concerned, you know, I refer to it as the murder of Abbot Whiting. You know, it's done under, you know, the law of the land, but it's, this, in my opinion, there's simply no need for it. You know, the other monks were kind of pensioned off. There were surely other ways to accomplish this. The brutality behind it and this blasphemy, yes, indeed, it's done to instill a sense of fear. And the mood, I can't even begin to imagine how horrifying it must have felt around the Abbey in the days, weeks and months following this.
Amazing.
Melancholy. You can still detect it from time to time. It wafts around the town, and the fact that this terrible act is not even really properly recorded on the Abbey website is a kind of strange thing, and that's why it's good that there's finally going to be an official event, however modest, next week that is going to be commemorating this.
Interesting as well that, you know, what Glastonbury has become, because it seems to have attracted all sorts of people that are interested in, you know, every kind of person along the spectrum of anything you could call spiritual, everything from sort of crystal shops to the goddess temple. Can you just give us an idea of some of the maybe more sensible and more outlandish things that are go on in Glastonbury today?
Well, that'd take a long time. Let's just say a few years back, we had an interfaith event celebrating unity and diversity, and we discovered that there were representatives of, I think it was somewhere in the region of 70 different faiths and beliefs. I mean, we're talking about different sects within Christianity or within Hinduism, and, you know, people that venerate different deities and different world traditions and so on and so forth. We all got together up at the famous Chalice World Gardens, and it was a sign of just, yeah, the incredible diversity. And in our calendar, yeah, we have the amazing Goddess Festival that happens at the beginning of August every year. You know, we have a procession through the town of the women with figurines and statues of the goddess, and they have a great feast and so on to celebrate the harvest. We've just last weekend celebrated some of the very old pagan legends surrounding this town about Gwyn, who is considered to be a lord of the underworld, who perhaps lives inside Glastonbury Tor and is an ancient pagan deity. And there was a dragon procession up Glastonbury High Street, and then an enormous great ceremonial with a bonfire at the foot of Glastonbury Tor. We have the Hare Krishnas have a little festival in the summertime, and they have a procession through the High Street. There's another dragon procession and celebration around the May Day period of time. There's a whole wheel of the year of absolutely extraordinary stuff that goes on. The local community are very, very creative about all of this, and a lot of visitors from all over, you know, not just this country, but all over the world come here all the way through these notable points on the calendar, you know, the solstices and the equinoxes and so on. So there's a kind of a spontaneous, you know, sociological, spiritual experiment going on here. And we're having a lot of fun, and it's very intriguing to see where it's going to go. The old history of the Abbey is very much resurgent at the same time.
What about the tower on the Tor? When was that? Was that built before or after the destruction of the Abbey and Richard Whiting, the abbot?
Right, well, what we've got there is the tower of a church that actually served a very small monastic community. If you think directly in front of that tower, just a little way down the slope, there was a building that was essentially a monastery. And, you know, there are monks living up on there. It all dates from the same period of time as the medieval abbey. And once we'd had the dissolution of the monasteries, it falls into disrepair, and it's just the tower that's left there that gives this very distinct, you know, visual sense to the tour.
So what's happening and where is it happening to commemorate Abbot Richard Whiting?
Right, okay, next Wednesday, the 15th of November at 10 o'clock in the morning in Glastonbury Abbey in the Patrick Chapel. Yeah, 10 o'clock is just a short event, 15 minutes or so. The normal admission fees to the Abbey apply. There's a chap called Mark Hutchinson who works in the Abbey as a historical reenactment figure. He goes around dressed in monk's robes and so on, but he is actually the Reverend, so he's entirely authentic in that. And he's somebody that's conducted some tremendous historical research in the Abbey. In the archives surrounding all this material, and is recovering the names, the biographies, all kinds of details of the monks that lived in Glastonbury during the last few hundred years before the dissolution. So he's a great guy to actually lead that. It will be a little remembrance, basically, of Abbot Whiting and his life and what happened, a bit of time for reflection. And if it's a nice day, I'm sure, you know, some of the people that gather there will hang around together in the grounds afterwards. It's just the beginning of what I hope is a greater acknowledgement of this terrible defining tragedy of, you know, why is the Abbey ruined? And why is there such a melancholy that sometimes settles over the town that seems to emanate from that tragedy? And hopefully, in 20 years or so's time, when we come to the 500th anniversary of this event, you know, maybe something quite important might be able to happen in Glastonbury as when it comes to commemorating the dissolution of the monasteries and what it's all about, how we should respond to it. Glastonbury's got, you know, as strong a claim as any to be able to speak about that.
Paul, can you just tell us whereabouts we can find your writing online as well as the book?
Right, okay. Well, my books are available on Amazon. I have got a website, Paul West in Glastonbury. I haven't updated much of it recently. I'm also present on the Spirit of Avalon Tours website. And, you know, I have a few. I've got a nice little video called A Glastonbury Abbey Dream that I put up on YouTube that's got a lot of images of Glastonbury Abbey and some appropriate music. And I'm hoping to develop that theme of music in the Abbey a little bit more with a bit of luck next year.
Okay, well, we'll put up a link to Glastonbury Abbey Dream on our show page at dialectradio.co.uk. Paul Weston from Glastonbury, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now I'm joined by Eric Simon from London. He's an independent researcher. He's just someone who is, I suppose, reading the papers like you and I. And his life experience has taught him that something's wrong, particularly with the money system. And I think many of us are aware it's almost a kind of angst that we know something's wrong. We're not quite sure what it is. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Tony.
Now, can you just take us through what you've discovered about money and what might be wrong with the current system that we've got?
Well, first of all, I think everybody should ask themselves if all these so-called public central banks were public, who would we owe the money to? Because we are all in debt, and how come this happens? You know, because we're all in debt, so it impacts a lot on public services and I don't know, research on greener energies, everything. You know, so to whom do we owe that debt? I think that's the main question people should ask, and how come we owe the debt to these people?
Okay, one of the things that's crossed my mind recently is that this quantitative easing money, this printing money, could just simply be printed and then used to pay the national debt off.
Well, it could well be, yes, because but at the same time, if we print money, who allow us to print it? And then will it create more debt or not?
Okay, so this is a key question here. How is money created?
Well, so far the money is created through officially public banks, you know, like normally it should be like the Bank of England or Bank of France or Bank of, you know, the Federal Reserve. But actually, if you search a bit deeper than that, you see that behind this, there are, in the UK, it's called accepting houses, I believe. And actually, these people are just acting in kind of a shadowy way as advisors and agreeing for the state to print the money and to print it for them and then lend it to the government and then asking they print money out of FOR, you know. They are, sorry, maybe not good to say it on radio, but out of thin air, let's say it like that, then they charge interest on this.
Now, we tend to think about money as something which is almost like solid, you know, like a piece of gold or something, but a piece of paper, a banknote, represents that piece of gold. And we tend to think about it as something which is a finite amount of it out there. But I'm not sure. Is that the case?
Well, I don't think it's the case. I think it's just digitally created nowadays. And I do even believe that is a shortage of cash relating to the amount of money created digitally, in fact. So I think that for long now, the money, you know, at least even the cash, has not been backed by gold in any way, you know, for about decades, I guess, you know. And the problem is, why do we allow these private hands to allow our, you know, tool, which should be a tool for a public central bank, to charge us money and charges interest out of nothing? Why don't we get this right back and pay no interest to these people? We should be on top of them. They shouldn't be on top of us. How come? God given right?
I think what you're saying is you're raising question about who's in charge. Is it the banks or the government?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's the banks. It's not the governments. And what we see nowadays, it's like some kind of a resignation of our state to rule and just being driven by the banks. Why? Because we are so much in debt. And why? Like recently, like last year or 2 years ago, George Osborne, which actually doubled the UK public debt, he created a new agency to actually start the sell-off of the UK family's jewels, you know.
So, Eric, listen, I'm going to give you the opportunity now to have a word in the ear of Philip Hammond, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Theresa May, the Prime Minister. What would you be saying to them now about what they should be doing in order to get the country back on track?
Well, I think simply to look and just to make public, to have people get aware how money's created and where that debt comes from, you know, and what's just to explain to the people, just basically, what are these accepting houses? Or in France, it's called SVT. In the US, it's called the Federal Reserve Board. And how come these people decide to create the money and charge us on this? So the main thing would be what? To make the public, the bank, our central banks really public and having the ability to print some money according to what the government wants and not these banks. Because the problem is the banks decide. The banks have a right to decide how the government will manage its money, how much it will pay back, when it will pay back this interest, that are absolutely undue.
Now, it sounds to me as if you're saying that we're being run really by the City of London.
Well, that's exactly what it is. The City of London, the Federal Reserve mainly, and they both control the European Central Bank. You know, this is not a critic against the British or the Americans or the French or whatever. It's a critic about a vampiring global banking network that sucks our wealth off. You know, that's the big problem. And they drive the war policies. They drive absolutely everything. And the few names in the UK controlling the Bank of England are the ones behind the accepting houses. Just use your browser and go on internet. You use your favorite browser, not to name any. And you just look for this accepting houses and you will find a few names. You Google on the French Treasury Agency, Agence France Trésor, and you Google SVT, Specialists in Treasury Value, okay? And you've got the same names everywhere behind the same scheme. I would call it a scam. It could be the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, or the ECB, and probably many, many other countries, you know?
So do you think it makes any difference which way we vote? Because obviously we want to have an influence on things like public services, like hospitals and schools.
I think it wouldn't make a difference if we had one politician saying we're going to change the money creation system. And I think at some point, from what I heard, that at some point Jeremy Corbyn was fully aware of this. He's not been very public about this recently, but... I heard that he was very much interested in changing all this. So that would be big, big, big hope, you know. And for instance, I don't think that it really matters who we work for, vote for, unless this system is changed, because actually none of these politicians are in charge.
Do you think there's any prospect of changing things?
I don't know. I think there is. There's always hope for this because I believe more and more people are getting aware of this, you know. And now it is to change the system and it is to... I don't know how we could kind of force politicians, intellectually force them to accept this and to stop hiding this, mostly. And to change all this, because the problem is, on whose payroll are these people? You know, which golden backdoor are these people promised to keep the lid on the money creation scam?
Okay, Eric, let's wind up by just taking a little bit of a look at foreign policy, because one of the things that a lot of people are saying to me, I don't know about to you, is it looks as if foreign wars are again being used to distract us away from what's happening at home. The austerity, you know, the disabled people having their money cut, people begging in the streets, that sort of thing. So what do you make of our foreign policy and who and what is it being directed? Who's directing it?
Well, obviously, it is very funny that it could be France recently, not always. Like, we refused to join the so-called coalition in Iraq in 2003. But I believe that the people driving, I would say, the Western nations' foreign policies are much linked to the ones who control money creation. And I believe that if you dig a little deeper, you find people with very pro-Zionist views, like the Rothschilds, like the Warburgs, because they are the one creating money in most of the Western countries, you know, behind the so-called public central banks. You know,
it almost seems like a kind of, and I think Vince Cable called it a magic circle, a bunch of people a bit like the Wizard of Oz who are really running things, invulnerable behind the scenes.
Well, yes. Yeah, I think so, yes. It's what have been recently the wars that the West wage. You know, Iraq, now they're talking about Iran, North Korea, Syria indeed, Libya. Are they all these countries friends of Israel? Or have they been labelled enemies of Israel?
Now, Eric, I just wonder if we could leave you, you can leave us maybe, with just one word for listeners out there about what can we do?
Share and raise awareness, just for people to get interested in how money is created and to whom and why we owe so much debt to so many, to just a few people.
But most of us haven't got the time to do this research.
I know. So it should be the media explaining people. I think, you know, recently there's been that gathering called Media on Trial, and I think we should hold them accountable for keeping the lid on such a scam for such a long time. They're fully aware of this, and they are much more guilty of it, I'd say.
Eric Simon, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And subscribe if you like, and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that is Elena Raman Durante, the photographer from Galicia, to Paul Weston from Glastonbury, and to Eric Simon, you just heard there. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
It's murder on the dance floor. But you better not kill the groove, DJ. Gonna burn this goddamn house right down.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Oh, I know. About your kind. And so and so and so and so and so and so and so, I'll have to play.
Here we go, together.
If you think you're getting away, I will prove you wrong. I'll take you all the way. Boy, just come along. Hear me when I say, hey. It's murder on the dance. But you better not kill the groove. Hey, 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 it's murder on the dance floor. But you better not steal the moves, DJ. Gonna burn this goddamn house right down. Oh, I know. There may be others. And so. You'll just have to.
You're
getting away, I will prove you wrong. I'll take you.
Going to speak again, isn't he?
I have come to show you.
This is Afterlife.
We'll be right back.
Well, I've just spoken rather inadvertently to them on the phone, and they're all ready to go there in a foreign pass. On Magic Eye Records from the LP The Space Between, this is Astralasia and Afterlife. Don't forget, tomorrow night between 8 and 10 on Radio 1, it's guided by Voices in Session on the programme. And now, as we've been threatening to do all afternoon, we go live to Ibiza. Here's Danny Rampling. Astralasia, and I always feel a bit bad because Astralasia put lots of good records and I never seem to get around to playing them because, frankly, they're too long. I know that's a ludicrous reason for not playing them, but it's the reason that I have to give. This is from the LP on Magic Eye Records called The Space Between.